720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday afternoon with me. Lots to do on the program today. A little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking again about Sears. They stay in the news. We talked about them just recently, but there are some new developments to this local brand. And we're also going to be talking about a very, very interesting fitness company that has a lot of people very excited. It's very interesting stuff. So we're going to be talking about that. But right now, we are joined by Robert McCartney, who is a senior regional correspondent at Washington Post, who wrote about the troubles facing Amazon's development of HQ2 in New York, another topic that we have talked a lot about on this program. Robert, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us today.
Good to be here, Amy.
So talk us through. I feel like we've so much in the last year have been talking about this second headquarters for Amazon and all their plans. And I know here in Chicago, that was a consideration that they might come here. And that sparked a lot of debate. And so what is happening in New York City?
Well, we broke a story yesterday. We posted online in the morning, quoting two unidentified sources saying that Amazon is reconsidering its plans to put half of HQ2, 25,000 good-paying jobs in New York. And they're reconsidering it because the local opposition is so strong. There's a lot of community groups and unions who are very unhappy about the plan to give up to $3 billion in subsidies to the company to put their jobs there. And the local opposition has got a lot of politicians, local politicians, especially from the city, who are objecting. The best known one is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the freshman congresswoman from a district right next to where Amazon would go. But the really crucial thing is that the state senate nominated a very strong opponent of the project to a little known state board that effectively could veto it. So all of this opposition and all of this pushback has got Amazon thinking maybe we shouldn't do this. The response in New York has been much more negative than in Northern Virginia, which has been very welcoming to the 25,000 jobs that are slated to come there. And also, they put, at the same time they announced the 25,000 each in New York and Virginia, they also announced 5,000 going to Tennessee, and Tennessee's been very welcoming too. So Amazon's basically thinking, why the heck are we going through with all this trouble in New York when other places are so eager to have us?
Right. And so if they were to abandon the plan for New York, what all would that cost them? How many plans have been laid so far that would need to be peeled back in?
I don't have a dollar figure for that. I know that they have not actually bought any land or leased any land yet in New York, so it would not be that difficult to pull out. It obviously would cost something, but I think the way they're looking at it, the way Amazon's looking at it is, hey, it's going to cost us a lot of money and take a lot of time before we're sure we can even put the jobs in New York, because New York isn't going to give final approval to the incentives package, the state part of the incentives package, until for more than a year from now. So this is going to, at the very least, this is going to drag on for more than a year before they're sure they've even got a deal.
Right. And, you know, and I think that's a part of this whole story that I think it's lost in the narrative a lot. It sounds like once Amazon, you know, made their announcement, hey, we're going to New York, it seemed like it was, you know, it was all set. It was a done deal. Everything was in agreement and everybody was happy with it and had worked out the details. And I think that gets buried in this conversation a lot, that there are still a lot of layers that require approval and so much attached to that. It's not just we're going here and we've made this deal and we've rented this property or bought it or whatever.
Right. Well, let's keep in mind, most, according to opinion polls in New York, most people, not just in the state, but in the city and even in Queens, in the borough of New York that's getting Amazon or is supposed to get Amazon, the level of popular support is very high, you know, by large margins. The popular opinion is in favor of bringing in Amazon. But the opponents, that's a small group of very well-organized, very militant, and effective opponents, and they are, you know, basically represent, you know, the left wing, the sort of anti-corporate wing of the Democratic Party there, which is a pretty potent force in a blue state, very blue state like New York. And they're making this a question of both pragmatism and principle. And they're able to block it because of the way the thing is structured. But let's be clear, Governor Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo, and Mayor Bill de Blasio are still very committed to this, and they're going to still... they're still determined to push this through, and I think there's some possibility that the Amazon is, you know, reconsidering this, that it's come out now that Amazon is reconsidering this because they want to put pressure on the opponents and sort of embarrass the opponents a little bit and strengthen the hand of those who support the deal. But this, at the very least, as I said, we're looking at months and months of prolonged battle, including between the governor and the state senate. So there's a lot of political turmoil yet to come on this, if indeed Amazon decides to stick with it.
Right. It will be very interesting. What is kind of the very next step that we can be watching for in that battle and in that oncoming turmoil that you described?
Right. There are two meetings later this month. There's going to be a third city council hearing. The first two, the Amazon executives were subjected to very hostile questioning, and there were a lot of protesters in the audience, and they booed and unfurled anti-Amazon banners. So we'll have a third council hearing, which promises to be equally tense, given what is now seen by opponents as a threat. Basically, Amazon's threatening the state. So we want to watch that. And then there's the first meeting of this little-known state board called the Public Authorities Control Board, which is where the state senate has a seat, and it's effectively a veto power over the whole project. So there will be a first meeting of that where this will get discussed. But I think the thing to watch is what happens at those two meetings, and also what goes on between the governor and the state senate. Because the way this deal was structured, they deliberately structured it to basically not give the city council a say. The city council is having hearings and making a fuss, but it's mostly for show, because they deliberately structured the deal in a way to keep the city council out of it and focus it in the state legislature. I think Amazon and the governor are very surprised that the legislature is putting up this much of a fight.
It is really, really fascinating. For those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and share this story after the program so that you can read it for yourself, because there are so many interesting details in it. Well, I thank you so much, Robert McCartney, Senior Regional Correspondent at Washington Post, for being with us today. We will keep turning to you as this story continues to unfold. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are going to be talking about a group of Chicago business leaders that they are calling for a $8 billion with a B tax hike. So we're going to take a look at that when we come back here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Lots to do on the program today. We're joined now by Dan Petrella, state government reporter at Chicago Tribune, who wrote about a group of Chicago business leaders that is calling for a significant tax hike in order to fix Illinois budgetary problems. So let's take a look at that. Dan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You bet. So talk us through this. And who is this group and what is their, what's the big vision here?
So the group is called the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club of Chicago. It's a group of leaders from some of the top companies in the city. And they've done this a couple times now. They put out a plan a couple years ago during the budget impasse under the administration of Governor Bruce Rauner, and now they've updated it as new Governor J.B. Pritzker gets ready to introduce his first budget plan later this month. And they are essentially proposing a combination of about $8 billion worth of tax increases and spending cuts to try to balance the budget. The main things I think that would probably catch people's attention would be increasing the state income tax again by 1 percentage point from 4.95% to 5.95%. And then something that's an often talked about issue in Springfield that doesn't ever seem to go anywhere, which is taxing retirement income, because Illinois is one of only a small handful of states that has an income tax but doesn't tax people's money during retirement.
And so how would that be taxed, and how would that begin to take shape if that were to pass?
They don't get into a ton of the specifics. Your pension check or your withdrawals from your IRA would be subject to the same income tax as any money that you earn on a regular job. Although they would, to kind of offset the impact on lower income seniors, they would increase the exemption for taxpayers 65 and older from $1,000 to $15,000, to try and kind of soften the blow on senior citizens who don't have quite as many resources.
Sure, sure. And so in your work reporting on this story, did you get the sense that like, how is this idea being received from this group? Is it being kind of, okay, you have a point, let's take a look, or is it being, is there pushback, or where is that landing?
Well, the retirement income tax part in particular is usually a pretty much a non-starter issue in Springfield. It's one that a lot of groups who put out budget plans like this endorse, because it's a big pool of money that is not currently being taxed. But it's one that, the AARP and groups like that fight really hard against in Springfield when it comes up. And there are concerns that taxing retirement income, which makes one of the, the lack of a tax on retirement income makes Illinois one of the more attractive states to stay in, and there's already concern about people leaving the state, and so that might drive retirees to move to other states. As far as the overall plan, the Pritzker administration was kind of non-committal about the specifics. They said they appreciate the input, and they'll continue having discussions with lots of groups as they put the budget together. But these proposals don't necessarily align with the kind of things that he talked about on the campaign trail, or that he's talked about so far in his first month or so in office.
That was my very next question, is how this all fits in with his, he's talked a lot about legalizing recreational marijuana and sports betting, and even, moving away from the flat tax to, greater taxing, or taxing higher earners at a greater rate. And so does this plan or this proposal take into account any of those things that he talked about throughout his campaign?
It didn't, and they acknowledged that somewhat, because particularly the graduated income tax proposal would take several years to implement, because it would require a constitutional amendment, which would have to be put on the ballot and then approved by voters. There are already interest groups that are gearing up to fight against that idea. Mm-hmm. So that would be several years before that could be implemented. And the Civic Committee was really trying to look at things that could be done more immediately. I guess one area where their ideas kind of do overlap is the Pritzker Transition Team put out some reports yesterday. And one of the ones on the budget sort of also mentioned the idea of expanding the state sales tax to some consumer services, although neither the Civic Committee nor the Pritzker Transition Team were specific about which services they think should be subject to the sales tax.
And so what are the next steps here? What are the, for people listening who want to monitor this or just kind of continue watching, I know it's sometimes always a jumble to watch things in Springfield because there's so much happening there, but what are the kind of the key things that people should be looking for next, or important dates coming up?
Sure. The next big thing is February 20th, when the governor will deliver his first budget proposal to lawmakers, and will speak to a joint session of the House and the Senate to deliver his budget address, and that will sort of lay out what his priorities are and how he thinks the state should spend its money. They put out a report yesterday saying that the hole that they're facing in next year's budget is even worse than the Renner administration had estimated before leaving office. They've put it now at about $3.2 billion that they have to figure out how to make up next year, either through a combination of new revenue from things like legalized marijuana and sports betting, or from some cuts. But he's also working, Pritzker is, to raise the minimum wage, which would have an impact on the state budget. And he's promised to make sure that the social service agencies and schools and things that would have to pay people more have the money from the state that they need to do that. So it's going to be interesting to see how they do that. They've promised a balanced budget. And often balanced budgets in Springfield rely on some gimmicks or sort of fantasy numbers, like selling the last state budget counted $300 million of revenue from selling the Thompson Center, which has not happened. So it'll be interesting to see how they make it balance.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's certainly a topic that gets people talking. We don't take a lot of calls on this show, but I certainly saw the phone lines light up. Esteemed producer Griffin Filipich handled them all, I'm sure. But, you know, it's one of those topics. We talk about this on the air, and a lot of people have a lot of things to say about it, because everybody's got, you know, a personal stake in it in some aspect of their lives. So I appreciate you talking with us today about this. Dan Petrella, state government reporter at Chicago Tribune. We will keep turning to you for the latest as this continues to unfold. Thanks for being with us.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on. Have a good day.
You bet. You too. All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always appreciate you for sharing part of your Saturday afternoon with us. We're joined now by Alexia Elejalde Ruiz, reporter at Chicago Tribune and regular contributor to this program, who wrote about Sears CEO Edward Lampert's successful bid to buy the retail chain. I know we've been talking a lot about Sears, but there is more. Alexia, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So the Sears story is so interesting to me. Not only is it the local tie-in, but it's just one of these stories that keeps going and keeps unfolding. And I think even as little as just a couple of weeks ago, I think we all thought Sears was kind of done, but that's not the case.
You're right. So I think we have thought that Sears is done for years now, I think. But Eddie Lampert, who you mentioned, he stepped down as CEO in October, actually, after the company filed for bankruptcy. So then it was like, okay, so is Sears really, really going to be done this time? But he had made an offer to save the company, basically. It was accepted, by the company. And then just this week, the bankruptcy court judge had to approve it, and he did. So basically, Eddie Lampert has bought Sears, which includes Sears and Kmart, for $5.2 billion with the intent of keeping a much smaller store base open, only 425 stores, which is down from like nearly 700 stores now. But he'll keep about 45,000 people employed.
And so what are the next steps as this goes on?
So, I mean, the sale has to close, and then obviously there are going to be about 262 stores, I think, will be closing by March to kind of get to that 425 store number. So a whole bunch of people will lose their jobs. And then, you know, Eddie Lampert says that this new strategy of kind of focusing on fewer stores that are already more profitable, as well as introducing smaller format stores that are focused on categories that Sears does well in, such as appliances, tools, that kind of thing, and like service repairs, that should be able to help turn the company around. People are quite skeptical of whether that's going to work, because he's been at the helm of the company for a long time, and it has not improved.
Well, that's a narrative that I think emerged just a couple of months ago, that a lot of people were talking about, that even if this deal were to happen, is he really the person to lead it? I think that a lot of people were kind of talking about that as this idea came up, that he would kind of make this last minute bid to try to save things.
Right, exactly, and he's not going to lead it as CEO. It's to be determined who will be in that role, but he's still obviously the biggest shareholder now. His hedge fund ESL Investments, which he's doing this deal through, is going to be in control of the company. So that's the big question: is whether he actually cares about Sears as a retailer, or if it's just kind of a cash cow for him and benefits him in other financial ways. So people are, you know, he's kind of been villainized over the years as running this, of running the department store chain into the ground by not investing in it, by just cutting costs and selling off assets, which he says is in order to keep it alive. And, you know, he says he's been loaning it a lot of money over the years too. But I think there's a broad concern that he does not actually have the employees or the stores or the legacy in mind.
Mm-hmm. Plus, I think just retail is such an interesting space right now, because so many people are going online for their purchases. Even when they're going into stores to look or mess with products, it seems like people are going back home and going online to buy things. So even just the retail game at all is interesting. But it seems like in this particular one, Lampert will be under so much scrutiny to watch his next moves.
Yeah, exactly. And you're totally right. I mean, Sears is not the only retailer, obviously, that's really been struggling over the years in the age of the internet and in the age of a lot of kind of discount stores putting up a lot of competition. But yes, he in particular is a figure who people are going to be watching very closely to see if he's doing anything to actually turn the company's fortunes around, or if this is more kind of like a game, you know, that he's playing to his own financial gain.
Yeah, so for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this story out after the program, because I want you to read it for yourself. There's some interesting quotes from the judge, Judge Robert Drain of the U.S. Bankruptcy Court. He had some really interesting things to say about it, and even pointing at this scrutiny, really, that, hey, this is not the time to screw around. You got to be serious about this. So I thought those were really interesting, because it conveyed a sense of like, hey, I'm going to let you do this, but don't screw it up. Like, it really had that kind of sense to it.
Oh, totally. I mean, it was a very, very long hearing, like very long proceedings, and the judge took an hour to give his ruling, kind of going step by step through all the reasons that he was going to approve the sale. Because there had been, you know, the people opposing the sale was a committee of unsecured creditors who wanted basically the company to liquidate instead, because they thought that there would be more value that they'd be able to get back than in keeping the store going. And, you know, some of the arguments that they put up were that, you know, that the process was flawed, you know, that the people who were evaluating the bid were biased, you know, towards Lampert, that Lampert had control over it, and also that, you know, they were skeptical that these stores that Eddie Lampert says that they're going to stay open, like, how long are they actually going to stay open for, you know, given Sears' history. So the judge was giving him a chance, and I think largely because he thought that saving these jobs should be a priority. But yes, he's also kind of given not a warning, but, you know, some advice to really listen to employees and as well as consumers.
Yeah, well, it will be very interesting to continue to watch this. I think a lot of people, as we said, are watching Lampert quite closely to see his next move. But I think he has also got a huge opportunity if he's truly going to reformat stores and make them more single focus and smaller. That might be really interesting and might be a really positive new chapter. So we shall see.
Yep.
Well, we'll keep turning to you for the latest. Thanks so much for being with us, Alexia Elhalde Ruiz, reporter at Chicago Tribune.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. All right, we're going to take a little break. Back in just a bit, and we're going to be talking about a fitness company that's got a lot of people talking. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Lots to do on the program today. We have been talking about all kinds of stuff, big business things and lots of billions of dollars being thrown around. But there is a fitness story that caught my eye. It is so interesting. And I hate being blindsided with trends, but I feel like that keeps happening to me. And suddenly there's like a big trend upon us. And I'm like, wait, what? What is that thing? In this case, there is a fitness product called Mirror. And it is this company. Lots of celebrities are behind it. There's a lot here. People are going quite wild for it. And Courtney Rubin, who is a freelance writer, wrote about this company for the New York Times, and she joins us now. Hi, Courtney. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. So tell us about Mirror and what has got everybody so excited about this company?
Well, I think the thing about it that's really cool is that you can do, I mean, so, you know, it's a mirror that you can either hang on your wall or have kind of freestanding. And basically when you turn it on, it becomes this kind of portal for all kinds of different workouts like boxing or, you know, cardio or yoga. And, you know, unlike sort of having a treadmill or a spin bike or something, you can do all these different things. And, you know, it's not this issue of, like, where do you put your computer? Where do you put your phone? Like, it's just you look in the mirror and you do the workout.
And a lot of celebrities have gotten attached to this. How did it first enter the celebrity realm? It's usually that first celebrity to get excited about it that kind of starts it all.
I do not know who the very first celebrity to sign on was. I mean, you know, this we live in this world of kind of influencers and things like that. And so I know that they gave mirrors to Sarah and Aaron Foster, who have a lot of famous friends, like Jennifer Aniston and, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow and things like that. And I think, you know, celebrities, they're just like us. They see it on Instagram. They see it at each other's houses. And literally that, you know, this thing just started and, you know, caught on like that. And, you know, people are gifting it and it just, you know, it's like they're just like us. They've seen it at each other's houses.
And so you turn the mirror on. It becomes like a fitness coach in there. There's like you don't have to go get a yoga teacher. A yoga teacher's there to do it for you. And so what are all the perks of it? Because it seems like it's very, very expensive. It seems a bit out of reach for most of us, about $1,500. But you have all this workout access. So what are the other things that it does?
Well, I mean, the thing that you get with it is, yeah, you have the instructor. And these are, you know, really, you know, sort of high level instructors, like, you know, and they take you through the, you know, it's basically like taking a class. Some of the classes are live. There's ones that you can get in the library. And so if you're taking a class that's live, you know, it pairs with a heart rate monitor or your Apple Watch, and the instructor can kind of see your heart rate, I think see your data. They can't see you, but, you know, they can see stuff like that, and you can get like shout outs during class and things like that. So in a way, it's, you know, it's basically being able to take a class in your house with all the kinds of things that involves, like having someone to motivate you as opposed to deciding 5 minutes through to turn it off and watch TV.
That's right. That's right. And so who is the company that is behind this product?
The company is, you know, Mirror, and its founder is Bryn Jeanette, who founded, she now has three of a boutique gym in New York called Refine Method. Bryn herself was a former New York City ballet dancer who went to Harvard, and when she was founding Refine, she did all this research for, like, you know, the most optimized workout and, you know, how to make everything super efficient. And then when she got pregnant, she sort of learned a lot from it, she told me, which was basically that, you know, she could have this super optimized workout but not feel like doing it. And so she kind of came up with this as this, what she was hoping would be a solution to kind of workout ennui, like, you know, all this choice and, you know, different. You can do a workout that's 15 minutes. You can do one that's 20 minutes. You can, you know, mix things up. You can do, you know, different things on different days, things like that.
Well, it is a very interesting product indeed. And it certainly addresses the hardest part of working out. And that is like getting your butt out the door, getting your gear on and getting your butt out the door and going to a class. And so, you know, in that regard, I think it's a very genius thing. And that's, I think, some of the best creations that we've talked about on this program have all come out of, here is a very specific problem that this person wanted to fix.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about it that I found so interesting is it's one thing to kind of, you know, she knew all this stuff about how to get fit, but then the big issue is when she really began to understand, I think, you know, we all sort of know what we should do. The question is, like, can we make ourselves do it?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well,
and you know that I don't know if this device makes you do it or not, but you know that I suppose that's the hope, that, you know, you have this thing sitting there and I don't know. Apparently it doesn't, you know, it doesn't nag you when it's not on, but I think if I walked by it all the time, I'd be thinking, I should use this.
Absolutely. And especially it's $1,500 and then you're paying a monthly subscription fee. I would certainly feel very guilty if I wasn't using it daily, for sure.
Yeah, I suppose. Although, you know, my parents were definitely these people who had an exercise bike that functioned as a clothing rack. So I don't know how guilty they felt or didn't feel about that.
There's that. That's a very, very good point indeed. Well, thank you so much for being with us. For those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet this story out after the program because it's a really, really interesting piece about this company and how this product has caught on and to fill this very interesting gap and this interesting problem. So thank you so much, Courtney Rubin, for being with us today.
Thank you.
You bet. All right. So, I don't know. Griffin, what do you think about this product? I think it's kind of like I don't know. It seems like a wild kind of thing. Like, I can't imagine spending $1,500 on a mirror, but I think it's a cool idea. And I love this kind of stuff that, like, fixes, like I told her, that, like, fixes a very specific problem. Like, this instructor said, okay, I get how to get fit, but, you know, like she told the reporter, I get how to get fit, I can't go. I can't go do that.
Yeah. Something about the mirror, too. You know, the headline was on that story was the most
narcissistic exercise equipment ever.
Which was not really the tenor of the piece, actually.
No, like, not at all. No.
They weren't. It wasn't a smear. But
no.
On like people who buy this just to look in the mirror. But I think there might be something to that. Not that it's bad, but like, you're constantly watching although the results happen in such slow time. Do you think that that's part of the appeal, though, is like the mirror of it all?
No, surely not.
I don't know.
I mean, surely not. I mean, to be honest with you, my favorite, you know, I'm a big yoga person.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite yoga places specifically goes out of its way to not have mirrors.
Because
they want you to just focus on how you feel rather than how you look.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that, I don't know. I think it's interesting.
I mean,
as someone who also teaches yoga, I'm very opposed to it because I'm like, just come to my class, please. I don't need you home. I need
you here in
the vibes, please.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I think there's a community aspect that would be kind of tricky about it.
Maybe we shouldn't be raising awareness for this product.
I know.
Sorry about that.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I would love to say I'll try one and get back to you, but it's $1,500.
And
I
then
will not
plus,
be doing
it's like $40 a month. So it is, you know, I mean, I guess that's what a gym membership about costs. But plus with the additional signing bonus of $1,500, that seems like a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot.
I'm good.
Yeah, I'm all set.
I know Ellen likes hers. Alicia Keys, there was a video of Alicia Keys getting
losing
one for Christmas.
Losing her mind.
She lost her mind.
Yeah, it was really funny. And her son gave it to her, right? Her kid, her friend?
And it was interesting to see this story, too. I don't know if you've seen the Peloton commercials that are kind of, like, big right now.
Yeah.
That's, like, also kind of a status symbol exercise object, the Peloton.
Definitely is.
And they also have a treadmill that I think they just introduced. It was the bike, and now they have a treadmill. I've been seeing those commercials everywhere lately. And they seem to want to expand their user base, but I don't know how. I just don't know. I guess what I was curious about was, like, who are they after?
Yeah, who are you that has all this stuff?
I guess the winter is a good time to push that stuff, too, because people want to go
outside.
Yeah,
you don't want to go outside during that.
Yeah.
Here's the thing.
I keep seeing the Peloton ads, though, and I'm like, okay, great. It looks fantastic.
Everybody on that ad looks so fit and happy and like, look how convenient it is. Just hop on the bike in your house. Here's the thing. I have a tiny apartment.
I just keep
Peloton would take up the whole thing.
Exactly. And it's just like, you're wasting your time on me. There's just no, it's not happening. But I don't have any space or the money to pay for it.
Yeah.
And I just feel like 90% of the people who see it will feel the same way.
Yeah.
I guess that's one good thing about the mirror is that it's just on the wall.
I mean, it is kind of like a thing that we talk about a lot in this program, though, right? That it's kind of things when we thought about, you know, decades ago, when we thought, what is the future? What are these technological things? And it was like the idea of communicating with a mirror. Like, that's a very Star Trek super future thing. And it's here, right? It's upon us. And you can get motivation and you can get... now, it would be nice on this mirror if you could set the motivation level. Because there's enough rebel in me that if someone... Like, if I went to, like, an aerobics class or something, which I would not do. If the instructor is, like... pushing very hard, my brain pushes back.
Oh yeah.
I'll intentionally, like, I don't get motivated by like a nagging or demanding drill sergeant kind of thing. Like, that doesn't do it for me. That in fact makes me rebel. But something like, challenge yourself to see if you can, like that kind of like, yeah, I can. If it's on me, I'll do it. But if it's like, so if you could, like, there was like a motivation dial on the side
it's
of
like
it.
Really intense workout, and then at the bottom it's like nap, like you have a nap instructor.
That's yoga at the end. You talk your people through Shavasana.
I guess that's true. Yeah.
Exposed. Yeah. Well, I'm a nap instructor. That's what I am. I'm a certified nap.
You're doing
instructor.
It wrong. Nap correctly.
You're doing it. Like if you could turn motivation factor way up, activity level way down. So it's like a really aggressive nap instructor. Oh, Griffin, we've lost our minds today.
No, we have a rival product that I think we're ready to bring to market now.
An aggressive nap instruction. We're going to start a podcast that's just like talking people through naps. We're under-caffeinated or over-caffeinated. That's what we are today. Well, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to check in and see what is happening on the Startup Showcase with our friend Scott Catoon, and we're going to go to news and all that good stuff. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.